Okay, so today's sutta is called the Mahasatchaka Sutta. It's number 36 of the Majjhimanikaya. Have you all got a copy of the sutta? Everybody okay? Yeah? Okay, good. So this sutta is really like a companion sutta with a sutta I did a few weeks ago, or a couple of months ago, or whatever. And this other sutta is called the Arya Paryasana Sutta, which means something like the Noble Search. And both of these suttas are about the life of the Buddha, and they are slightly different, so they complement each other in a very nice way, and you get a very kind of good understanding view of the life of the Buddha, at least up to his enlightenment experience. So how he was thinking, what he was doing just before he got his full awakening experience. And these two suttas sort of go together. This particular sutta here is given to a fellow called Satchaka, and he's like a debater, runs around debating all kinds of people. And in the previous discourse, just before this one, which is number 35, he has like a debate with the Buddha, and now he comes back for more, basically. That's what's happening here. This is like the second debate between this fellow Satchaka and the Buddha. And apparently he's quite well known, this Satchaka. So I'll just get on with the sutta. It goes as follows. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Vesali, in the great wood in the hall with the peaked roof. Now, on that occasion, when it was morning, the Blessed One had finished dressing and had taken his bowl and outer robe, desiring to go into Vesali for alms. Then, as Satchaka, the Niganta's son, was walking and wandering for exercise, he came to the hall with the peaked roof in the great wood. The Venerable Ananda saw him coming in the distance and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, here comes Satchaka, the Niganta's son, a debater and a clever speaker, regarded by many as a saint. He wants to discredit the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. It would be good if the Blessed One would sit down for a while out of compassion." The Blessed One sat down on the seat made ready. Then Satchaka, the Niganta's son, went up to the Blessed One, exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down and said to the Blessed One. So here you have this fellow, a Niganta, who's a clever debater and speaker, and he is regarded by many as a saint. And you can see how this often is the case, that if you are a good speaker and you are articulate and maybe you have some charisma on top of that, it doesn't take that much to be regarded as somebody special. And that was so in those days, and that is still so in the present day, pretty much. He's called here the Niganta's son. Basically, the Nigantas are the Jains. And the Niganta's son here is a very literal translation, which basically just means a follower of the Jains. That's what it means. It doesn't actually have any direct, doesn't actually mean any direct reference to being the son. It's just like you are part of a group, so you are a son of that group, so to speak. And then he says here that it would be good for the Buddha to sit down out of compassion. And we may ask, well, out of compassion for whom? And I think many people here are included. Obviously, it's out of compassion for Satchaka himself, who from a Buddhist point of view is likely to have some strange ideas, so to sort of maybe help him out and see more clearly. But also very likely out of compassion for other people, because if somebody is regarded as a saint by many people, usually they are in a kind of powerful position. They will influence other people. And of course, all these other people who are influenced by Satchaka, they will also benefit if Satchaka is more has a more clear view about what actually is, how things are and how they're not according to reality here. So basically, it's out of compassion for everybody, I think. There might also have been some monks around at this time, and it might also have been out of compassion for those monks to have a debate about Dhamma issues. Okay, then Satchaka says to the Buddha, "Master Gotama, there are some recluses and Brahmins who abide pursuing development of the body, but not development of the mind. They are touched by bodily painful feeling. In the past, when one was touched by bodily painful feeling, one's thighs would become rigid, one's heart would burst, hot blood would gush from one's mouth, and one would go mad, go out of one's mind. So then the mind was subservient to the body. The body wielded mastery over it. Why is that? Because the mind was not developed. But there are some recluses and Brahmins who abide pursuing development of the mind, but not development of the body. They are touched by painful mental feelings. In the past, when one was touched by painful mental feelings, one's thighs would become rigid, one's heart would burst, hot blood would gush from one's mouth, and one would go mad, go out of one's mind. So then the body was subservient to the mind. The mind wielded mastery over it. Why is that? Because the body was not developed. Master Gotama, it has occurred to me, surely Master Gotama's disciple abide pursuing development of mind, but not development of the body. So this is his theory here, or his ideas about development of the body and the mind. And I must admit, it's not entirely clear to me exactly what he's trying to say here. But it becomes clear later on that what he means by development of the body are ascetic practices. So that is what development of the body means here. And this, of course, was one of the standard ways of practicing, of religious practice at the time of the Buddha, was doing very severe ascetic practices, the Attakilamatana Yoga, or the mortification of the body. And what he's saying here, well, if you do those, take those too far, then it becomes so painful that you lose your sanity, basically. And in this case, he's saying that the mind is subservient to the body. That's his idea here. And the other way around, where he talks about the body being subservient to the mind, I don't really know what he's talking about. And it becomes clear later on that he doesn't really know, he doesn't really have any idea at all of what development of the mind actually is. Of course, in Buddhism, development of the mind means meditation practice, and it means like samadhi in particular. But that is what it is in the Buddhist teachings, whereas Satchaka doesn't seem to have any ideas about what that might mean. So then we will see what the Buddha has to say about these things, because this is obviously not in accordance with how the Buddha looks at things. But Agivesana, this is the Buddha speaking now, back to Satchaka. Agivesana seems to be his first name or his family name or something. But Agivesana, what have you learned about development of the body? Well, there are, for example, Nanda Vatsa, Kisa Sankitsa, Makkali Gosala. They go naked, rejecting conventions, licking their hands, not coming when asked, not stopping when asked. They do not accept food brought or food specially made or an invitation to a meal. They receive nothing from a pot, from a bowl, across a threshold, across a stick, across a pestle, from two eating together, from a pregnant woman, from a woman giving suck, from a woman in the midst of men, from where food is advertised to be distributed, from where a dog is waiting, from where the flies are buzzing. They accept no fish or meat. They drink no liquor, wine, or fermented brew. They keep to one house, to one morsel, to two houses, to two morsels, etc., all the way up to seven houses and seven morsels. They live on one saucerful a day, on two saucerfuls a day, on seven saucerfuls a day. They take food once a day, once every 2 days, up to once every 7 days. But thus, even up to once every fortnight, they dwell pursuing the practice of taking food at stated intervals. So this, obviously, here is the practice of self-mortification, as it was done by many of these saints at the time of the Buddha, and apparently in India, even to this day, this is what certain of these people, these ascetics, do even to this present day. And these are just various ways of practicing these ascetic practices. And then the Buddha asks Satchaka, but do they subsist on so little, Agivesana? No, Master Gotama. Sometimes they consume excellent hard food, excellent soft food, taste excellent delicacies, drink excellent drinks. Thereby they again regain their strength, fortify themselves, and become fat. And the Buddha replies, what they earlier abandoned Agivesana, they later gathered together again. That is how there is increase and decrease of this body. But what have you learned about development of the mind? So, interesting here, he's basically admitting that, you know, this kind of practice, they do it for a while, and then when the body gets too weak, they give it up, and then they put on weight again by eating all kind of nice food. And then the Buddha says, and I guess there might be a slight indication of humor here, he says, well, this is how the body comes to increase and decrease, and that is really what that practice is about. Which is a nice, pretty much straightforward way of putting it, I think. Yeah. They say here, they talk about excellent hard foods and excellent soft foods. Now, this is a distinction that you find in the Vinaya of the monks. And what is called hard foods here, or rather what is called soft foods, are really things like staple foods, ordinary foods, whereas hard foods are like the more finer foods that you sometimes can get. So that is really what this distinction is about. Please, if anybody has any questions as we go along, just please raise your hand and we can take questions as we go along. That's perfectly fine. Yeah. So that is the Buddha saying, well, this is not really getting you anywhere. All you're doing is increasing and decreasing your body. What's the big deal? What does this actually do for you? That's essentially what he's saying about these practices. And we will see later on how the Buddha also describes his own ascetic practices before his enlightenment. When Satchaka, the Nigantha son, was asked by the Blessed One about the development of the mind, he was unable to answer. Then the Blessed One told him, what you have spoken of as development of body, Agivesana, is not development of body, according to the Dhamma in the Noble One's discipline. In other words, in the Buddha's dispensation. Since you do not know what development of body is, how could you know what development of mind is? Nevertheless, Agivesana, as to how one is undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind, and developed in body and developed in mind, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, sir, Satchaka, the Nigantha son, replied, and the Blessed One said this. Now, you may have noted here that the Buddha says that if you are not even developed in body, how could you know what development of mind is? And what you're seeing here, you're seeing the gradualness of something. Development of body, according to Buddhism, is something which comes first, and development of mind comes afterwards. And the reason for that is because, and we will see this later on, is that development of body, what the Buddha means by that, is basically sense restraint and mindfulness. In other words, you restrain your senses, you have awareness and mindfulness around your senses, not to allow desire and aversion to arise regarding sense objects. In other words, you keep your mind pure. You don't allow it to be taken away by these desires and aversions, and then make it unfit, if you like, for samadhi and for spiritual practice. And of course, that sense restraint comes before you can have any samadhi and before you can have any proper meditation. And because that is the meaning of development of the mind, you can see why one comes before the other. So if you don't know what even one is, much less can you know anything about the other one. And then the Buddha replies how he understands these things. And how, Agivesana, is one undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind? Here, Agivesana, pleasant feeling arises in an untaught ordinary person. Touched by that pleasant feeling, he lusts after pleasure and continues to lust after pleasure. That pleasant feeling of his ceases. With the cessation of the pleasant feeling, painful feeling arises. Touched by that painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, laments. He beats his breast and becomes distraught. When that pleasant feeling has arisen in him, it invades his mind and remains because the body is not developed. And when a painful feeling has arisen in him, it invades his mind and remains because his mind is not developed. Anyone in whom, in this double manner, arisen pleasant feeling invades his mind and remains because body is not developed, and arisen painful feeling invades his mind and remains because mind is not developed, is thus undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind. So here you can get a little bit more idea of what's going on. The first one here, he says that one is touched by pleasant feeling. And this normally means touched by sensory pleasant feeling. And when that you're touched by those feelings, then you lust after. Lust here just means desires, basically. You desire those feelings, whatever they may be, through the five senses, basically. And that desire for those feelings, when you have that desire there, when you have this kind of attraction to these feelings, that is when you lose your mindfulness, because your mind gets carried away. You lose your sense of clarity. And this is where sense restraint comes into the picture. Sense restraint is the ability to see, to stop yourself from running after these objects and desiring them, for being too attracted to them, so that you lose your mindfulness and your presence of mind here and now. Yes. The thing is that you have to. It's how you enjoy these things, right? And it's the thing is that you shouldn't have like. If you sit in the sun, if you have like a good meal or whatever, if you get carried away and you have like a desire, continuous desire and attraction to that meal, so you lose your mindfulness, you lose your state of presence of mind. That is where it really, really happens. It depends on whether you indulge in it or whether you just see it as a pleasant state without any further indulgence. That's what it means. It depends. It really depends on how that desire is. But usually desire tends to bring you out of the present moment, right? But it really depends on how you use it. I guess it depends on. I guess it depends on when you do it. I mean, I guess it all depends on how exactly you do it. I guess there are many ways of doing it, I suppose. But if you, I think if you get too carried away by any kind of pleasure, any kind of physical pleasure, I would say, generally speaking, you tend to lose your mindfulness if you're carried away. I mean, think about yourself having a good meal, for example. There's pleasure there, I guess one of the aspects here is that you, if you are not careful, you will think about it afterwards, and you will think about it afterwards that this was an enjoyable meal, I won't have it again in the future, and you will fantasize about it, and that is where the mindfulness tends to disappear, that is where you have to be careful. And I think if you attend to that meal wrongly while you're there having the meal, then you will tend to fantasize about in the future. So if you look upon it in the wrong way while you're having it, then that may actually affect how you relate to it in the future as well. I think it all depends on the. It also depends on kind of where your meditation is at as well. I mean, it might be that if you are very adept at samadhi, you will look at these things quite differently. And that is really the thing here. You are, and this is the other thing. The other aspect of this whole thing here is that that is where the pleasure arises. The pleasure doesn't invade the mind. And the reason for that is because you have another refuge. You have a refuge in your samadhi instead, and the pleasure of meditation practice. So because of that, when the pleasure arises, you don't actually get carried away by the pleasure because you have something else. And this is what the other aspect is about here. So it all depends. And I think you're probably right. I think that for the vast majority of people, if you haven't got that samadhi, you have to enjoy the sensual pleasures. And this is one of the things that you find in another sutta in the to Mahanama, I think it's Majjhima Nikaya 13 or 14, when Mahanama goes to the Buddha and says, sometimes I sort of find myself fantasizing or thinking about sensual pleasures. And the Buddha said, well, that's the way it is. It has to be like that. Because unless you actually attain to those happiness, which is more profound than that, which means basically the jhanas and higher states, that's natural for the mind to do that. It is a natural process. So this, you're talking about fairly high states here already. This is the sutras for you. Sutras often talk about very high things. I think that's important too. It is definitely important to keep that in mind, I think.
It's how you relate to them, which is the most important thing here. If the mind sort of goes following, once you've had that pleasure, the mind keeps sort of attaching and holding on to it afterwards. That's when you start thinking and fantasizing and dreaming about these things. And that is where the problem really arises. That's when you really lose your mindfulness. So it really depends on how you're relating to that pleasure here. It's the most important thing here. Yeah, but I think it also relates to how you are actually dealing with that pleasure while you're having it relates to how you actually think about it in the future. So if you're having a meal as a monk, you ideally you want to be mindful, so that when you have your mindfulness there, rather than kind of losing your mindfulness in the food, you have a sense of mindfulness, basically means a sense of distance, right? You're enjoying the food without kind of allowing your mind to get drawn into it. It's like the old simile of the movie. You go to the movies, and you can either have a sense of perspective where you sit back and you see, oh yeah, it's just a movie, or you can get so drawn in that you are overwhelmed with emotions. You cry when the hero on the screen cries, and you are sort of jubilant when they kind of beat the bad guy and all these kind of things. And that's what movies are all about. Movies are about drawing you in and sort of manipulating your emotions. That's the whole purpose of it. And if you sit back and you just watch it as a film, the enjoyment probably, you don't have the same, it's a different kind of enjoyment in that case. And I think it's the same with food, the same thing with any experience. Ideally, you want to be mindful in the sense that you have a sense of distance to the object. You don't allow yourself to get drawn in. If you get drawn in, it means that you are, that is where the fantasizing and the lack of mindfulness, in the future will lead to further problems in the future. Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's all about mindfulness all the way. When you get too tired, as you say, then the mindfulness decreases, and that's why you walk around like a zombie. You haven't got that clarity anymore. You haven't got that distance. You're just, So that's true. So ideally, you try to avoid getting that tired, basically, so that you don't get to that point. Ideally, because then it's Right. Right. So that's a good point. So that means you have to be careful to avoid getting into that state in the first place, basically. Yeah, that's quite right. Yes. Those answers was a sensual desire, Yeah. Well, they are still there at the first stage of enlightenment. Usually, they say that the third stage, when they become anagami, is when they cease. So that's the asava, or the outflowing of attachment to sensual desire, if you like, or having an attraction at all to sensual pleasures. So, yeah. Third stage. Yeah. Third stage. Three. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, some of it has already ceased at the first stage, because there are only certain things that you can do when you get, once you get to the first stage, they say you cannot be reborn in the very bad realm anymore. So that means that those actions that would have led to rebirth there, they have already ceased. So already you have refined it down a little bit. So. Yeah, precisely, because you're always seeking for happiness, and if you haven't got the happiness somewhere else, you will find it in the sensual realm, and that's just natural. That's just the way it is. So yeah, that's precisely right. Yeah. So I think the point you're making, Rodney, I think that it's an important point, is that you have to be careful not to sort of become a person who is too strict on yourself and thinking that sort of it's not really about avoiding pleasure so much as to remaining mindful. It's better to think of it as remaining mindful of what you're doing rather than as actually avoiding pleasure. It's not really about avoiding pleasure, but remaining mindful. And if you have that ability to remain mindful, then you will see that ability to remain mindful is usually a greater pleasure than to sort of allow your mind to sort of get drawn into the activity. Because mindfulness gives you a sense of control. It gives you a sense of being in charge. It gives you a sense that you can, you are the master of your destiny, about your emotions and your feelings and everything, rather than allowing yourself to be pulled away by these things. Obviously very hard. Obviously very difficult. And I think in lay life it's even more difficult than in monastic life. So I think that's no doubt true. So be careful. It's not about denying pleasure, denying. It's just about. It's also about very much about where you are on this path as well, which is important to take into account. But the Buddha normally doesn't talk very much about sense restraint to lay people. Usually, when he talks to lay people, it's more about make sure you keep ordinary virtuous behavior first of all, and then maybe when you go on retreat or something, then you might find that you get more into the sense restraint of things.
It's not about, I think that's not really sense restraint. I mean, when you don't hear anything at all, it's not really sense restraint anymore. That's actually cutting off the senses altogether. That's a different thing here. Sense restraint leads up to that. The sense restraint is not about not hearing or not seeing certain things. It's about not reacting in a certain way to things. So when you have when you see something you find attractive or beautiful, you don't allow that attraction to sort of invade your mind and allow you to lose your mindfulness, lose your presence, lose your distance, if you like, to the object, allow yourself to get carried away. Or in the same way, if you see something unpleasant, you keep a sense of distance. You realize that if I keep watching on this unpleasant experience, I will lose my mindfulness, I might get upset, I might get angry, all these things might happen. I don't want that to happen, so I'll just keep a sense of perspective on this. Perspective, I think, is a good way of looking at a sense restraint. But again, it is actually, generally speaking, a very high kind of practice. When you purify sense restraint completely, it actually means that you have constant mindfulness as well, because those two things go together. So it is a very refined practice. Anyway, so I think we better move on, otherwise going to be here for a long time. So this is the two types of sense restraint that he's talking about here. And the first one, to avoid the pleasure invading your mind,
means that you restrain your senses, you keep a sense of mindfulness, a certain distance to the object, not allowing yourself to be drawn in. And the other one, which is avoiding the painful feeling to remain and invade the mind, well, here, this seems to mean, I think, that he has another refuge. He has the refuge of samadhi, the refuge of meditation, which can always give rise to a sense of happiness and contentment in this particular person. So because you have this other refuge, you're not so concerned about bodily painful feelings. But if your entire experience, your entire refuge is the body, is the five senses, well, then obviously painful feeling becomes very traumatic. This is the difference here. And in both cases, you don't allow these things to invade your mind. You keep your mindfulness, you keep a sense of distance, you keep a sense of perspective on this issue, on these things. And this is always a gradual thing. And it's possible to, of course, be more or less sense-restrained. It's possible to have more or less mindfulness. And you can see that in daily life. People react in different ways. Some people will react to a very small provocations or small problems or small things. Whereas other people, they have more of a sense of being in control of themselves. And those people who are more in control of themselves, essentially, they have more mindfulness and also more sense-restraint. That's one way of looking at it. And then the Buddha says, well, and how, Agivesana, is one developed in body and developed in mind? Here, Agivesana, pleasant feeling arises in a well-taught, noble disciple. Touched by that pleasant feeling, he does not lust after pleasure or continue to lust after pleasure. That pleasant feeling of his ceases. With the cessation of the pleasant feeling, painful feeling arises. Touched by that painful feeling, he does not sorrow, grieve, and lament. He does not weep, beating his breast, and become distraught. When that pleasant feeling has arisen in him, it does not invade his mind and remain, because his body is developed. In other words, he has that sense restraint and mindfulness. And when that painful feeling has arisen in him, it does not invade his mind and remain, because his mind is developed. And mental development, again, means samadhi. It means a deep states of meditation. Anyone in whom, in this double manner, arisen pleasant feeling does not invade his mind and remain, because body is developed, and arisen painful feeling does not invade his mind and remain, because the mind is developed, is thus developed in body and developed in mind. So this is then development in body and development in mind, according to the Dhamma, the Buddha's teachings. And you will see here that the contrast in the one who is undeveloped and the one who is developed, the first one is said to be an untaught, ordinary person, and the second one, a well-taught, noble disciple. And a noble disciple usually means somebody who has seen the Dhamma for themselves, like a stream enterer or somebody even closer to enlightenment. And of course, the untaught, ordinary person is somebody who has not seen the Dhamma, somebody who is particularly somebody who has no understanding of the Dhamma at all. So the contrast is very sharp here between these two. One is obviously on the way to enlightenment, the other one is very far away. And so often the Dhamma is presented like this. You take a very sharp contrast, because that is where the contrast is very clear. But of course, the reality is that there's a whole range of intermediate things here between the one who's completely untaught and the one who is already an Arya. And all those ranges in between, there will be more or less mindfulness, more or less sense restraint, depending on what stage you're at. This is an important thing to understand with how the Dhamma is often taught. Okay, then, Satchaka says the following. I have confidence in Master Gotama. Thus, Master Gotama is developed in body and developed in mind. And the Buddha replies, surely, Agivesana, your words are offensive and discourteous, but still I will answer you. Since I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness, it has not been possible for a risen pleasant feeling to invade my mind and remain, or for a risen painful feeling to invade my mind and remain. It says here that your words are offensive and discourteous. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but I think it may have to do with the fact that he is trying to get out of the Buddha, whether he is, basically he's asking a question here. He's stating something in presumably a provocative manner, and that's why the Buddha calls it offensive and discourteous. That's my hunch as what is happening here. But I'm not entirely sure why it is. And presumably in those days it was considered impolite or wrong to go around asking, you know, a spiritual master whether he has attained anything. Are you developed in body and mind? Probably that was considered not correct. And that is even true today. It would normally not be considered right to go up to ask somebody in all seriousness whether they, you know, are you enlightened or something. It probably wouldn't be usually not considered right. And anyway, as a monastic, you cannot tell usually people that whether you are, what kind of states you have attained. Okay, and then the Buddha says that he has never had any of these, neither pleasant feelings nor painful feelings, invade his mind or remain since the time he shaved off his hair and beard. So in other words, ever since he left the household life, even before he got enlightened or awakened, already his mindfulness and his sense restraint was so strong that none of these things actually took over his mind. Yes? That's what it seems like, yeah. That's what it seems like, in my opinion, yeah. And there are, Well, I don't know whether, if it was, even if it wasn't jhana, it probably was some kind of other state of samadhi. Maybe it was nimittas or something like that, you know, a state of bliss, a state of kind of release from the body at least. I think that's what it was. Because it seems quite clear that the Buddha didn't actually attain jhana until later on. And he actually says he was afraid of the jhanas, it says later in the sutta. So obviously if you're afraid of the jhanas, it means you didn't actually attain them. But the Buddha also says in other places, he says, for example, in the Dvairabhitaka Sutta, Two Kinds of Thought, Majjhima 19, he says that this was while he was a bodhisattva, he would attain samadhi to ease the body and to ease the mind. He says that in there as well. So it seems to me that from reading the suttas overall, that yes, the Buddha did actually attain samadhi quite early on, but he sort of just used it to sort of ease his practice. As part of the ascetic practices, I think. Probably not, no. Yeah, that's what I would think. But I think there is probably more overlap here than you think. I mean, in the suttas, it's very kind of, everything is very compartmentalized. It did this and did that, you know. And then he did the three kind of vijayas on the last night of his, before he became full enlightened, everything in one go. But I think a lot of these things probably a bit more overlap. The time periods are probably much longer than it seems to be in the suttas, I would think. Things didn't happen quite so fast. And when you read it carefully, I think that's what comes out of the text as well, when you read it like that. Yeah, I don't think, I mean, it's possible, but I think that's it quite likely was much, much longer period. Yeah. Okay, then Satsaka says to the Buddha, has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so pleasant that it could invade his mind and remain? Has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so painful that it could invade his mind and remain? And the Buddha replies, why not, Agivesana? Here, Agivesana, before my enlightenment or awakening, while I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, I thought, household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. So here is the Buddha thinking about why he should go forth. And he says that the household life is crowded, that's self-explanatory, lots of people, And dusty is often a metaphor for like the defilements. It's very easy for the defilements to arise when you are around a lot of people all the time. All things are happening. And it's often said that people often have a lot of dust in their eyes. It means they don't see clearly. And often that, of course, is a reference to defilements that hinder that clarity of seeing. So you're seeing that basically, if I'm going to be able to go forward in the practice, I need more space. And this is the life gone forth is wide open. And then later on, after having had this thought, while still young and a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, etc. And this is all as in the Majjhima 26, which I read out a couple of months ago. All the same thing. And in that sutta, it then goes on to say that after he went forth like this, then he sought out other teachers. And he sought out, in particular, the two famous teachers called Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, who obviously were quite famous in those days. And then having practiced with these two teachers for a long time and having attained what could be attained under those teachers and realizing that that wasn't enough because it didn't make an end to the suffering that he could see in the world, then he decided to go on his own and try to find a solution to the problem of suffering. And I always find it fascinating here, even the Buddha, somebody who was so spiritually attained, somebody who attained the jhanas while he was a child, somebody who was very special in many ways, even he was humble enough to go out and say, I will seek out the advice of other teachers before I go out on my own. I think that's very significant because it shows us that in the world, usually there are people who are more spiritually advanced than we are. So it's always very advisable and very useful to seek those teachings rather than actually just go out on our own and do things. Sometimes you read about these people who think, I'm just going to do everything by myself and sort of find my own way. And you can even read certain websites on the internet. You see people with a name and they have like Arahat next to it in parentheses. there's a lot of ego, often it seems, in some of these things. And it's the kind of often the ego that wants you to sort of go out there and do it all by yourself rather than rely on that help which actually is available out there. And even the Buddha, as I said here, he is humble enough to say, okay, well, let me first of all see what's available before I strike it out on my own. And that's what he did here. So that you can read about that in more detail in Majjhima 26. And then after the Buddha has then left these two other teachers and found a nice place for himself, and this place that he has found is on the bank of the Uruvela River, and that is the place which these days is known as Bodh Gaya in India. In other words, the place where the Buddha is supposed to have attained enlightenment. And presumably that is roughly the spot that still is there to this present day, and we can actually visit that spot. I think it looks very, very different now from what it did at the time of the Buddha. If you go there now, it's very crowded, lots of people, all kinds of things happening. Of course, in those days, it was a very peaceful and beautiful place. Anyway, so the Buddha goes here, he sits down and starts to practice. And then he says, now these three similes occur to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying in the water? No, Master Gotama. Why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood, and it is lying in the water. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Agivesana, as to those recluses and Brahmins who still do not live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst and fever for sensual pleasures have not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally, even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feeling due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, They are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. This was the first simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. So the point of a simile here is fairly self-explanatory. Obviously, the piece of wood lying in the river or lying in the water is like a person being in the world in the middle of sensual pleasures and just enjoying themselves with sensual pleasures, doing all kinds of stuff and just getting kind of addicted and intoxicated by those sensual pleasures, like most people do. And the fact that the piece of wood is wet and sappy means that not only are you in the middle of sensual pleasures, but you are also you also have desires for sensual pleasures. And that desire for sensual pleasures is like the sappiness inside of you. So you are both indulging and you are in the middle of them and you have the desires. You have two aspects there. And if you have that state, in other words, you haven't given up that desire for sensual pleasures, then you are incapable, it says here, of a full awakening or even knowledge and vision, which would mean any lower kind of awakening as well. Then again, Agyavesana, the Buddha says, a second simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agyavesana? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? No, Master Gotama. Why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood, even though it is lying on dry land far from water. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Agyavesana, as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, for example, you live in a hut in the forest somewhere far away, but whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally, even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if they don't feel these painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are still incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. This was a second simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. So here the point, of course, is that if you want to overcome sensuality, it is not just enough to remove yourself from sensual things, you know, like going to live in a small hut in the forest somewhere and not have any sensual contacts directly around you. You have to actually abandon it in the mind. You have to abandon the desire internally. And that is the only way to overcome that first hindrance. And that is the point here. So, of course, in those days there may have been, and it may be quite common today at any time, for example, take a monk who lives in a forest monastery somewhere. It is not just enough to sit in that cuti far away. You also have to make sure that you are internally, your mind also is purified of these desires. Otherwise, you are just as incapable as you were before. Again, Agyavesana, a third simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agyavesana? Could the man light a fire and produce the heat by rubbing it against a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? Yes, Master Gotama. Why so? Because it is a dry, sapless piece of wood, and it is lying on dry land far from water. So too, Agyavesana, as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasure and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst and fever for sensual pleasures has been fully abandoned and suppressed internally,
even if those good recluses and Brahmins do feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening here. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening here. This was the third simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. These are the three similes that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. So here, the Buddha is saying that only when you abandon that desire, you abandon the sensual pleasures, both externally, by not having any contact with them, and then secondly, by restraining the desire for these things inside, when both of those aspects have been taken away, only then is it possible for you to actually achieve that insight, which either leads to full awakening or even lesser insights like stream entry or even deep meditation like the jhana, any kind of super, what they call the superhuman stage, the Uttari Manusadhamma. Yes, sir. Sometimes it is. I mean, obviously, for a piece of wood, it is. For a person who does this, I think it is. It's a combination of things. If you are wise and you practice in the right way, then it is a matter of time before it dries out, and the sensuality will eventually disappear by itself if you practice the right way. But if you're not wise and if you act in the wrong way and you don't. When you see something beautiful, you do actually allow your mind to follow after it. When you think a thought of some sort of desire, you allow your mind to follow after it, rather than to try to think of the disadvantage, think of the danger in this, all these things, then it may not dry out. So it's all about how you practice with these things. And it's very important that you actually, you do more than just wait, so to speak. If you just wait, it may never actually happen. Yeah. Because the simile here seems to imply that if you just take it out and leave it long enough, it will come out. That's true. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that if you live in a place where there is a lot of sensual input around you. It is very hard often to actually abandon the desire because of always you have the input and the impact on your senses all the time. So for that reason, the first movement very often of the recluses and Brahmins or monks or whatever, or even if you go on a retreat or whatever, is to remove yourself from that environment. That's the first step. And only then is there really a realistic chance of actually cutting off the second one, which is the desire inside. So what I meant simply was that I divided up the first of all, the impact from the outside, which tends to stimulate that sensual desire. And then I looked at the sensual desire as a secondary thing, which is like the internal thing. That's what I meant by that. So he says here that as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasure and whose sensual desire, affection, thirst, infatuation, and fever for sensual pleasures has been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. No, I don't think it means, I think it just means your personal desires. That's all it means. I think it's the distinction between the external object, which gives rise to that, can give rise to that desire if you are unskillful in the way you look at it, and the desire itself, which is just the internal thing. I think that's what it means. I don't think it has any further implications. And I should also maybe point out here that it says here fully abandoned and suppressed internally. I think it's important to not to misunderstand the meaning of the word suppressed here. Suppressed doesn't mean that you use your mind and kind of suppress these things. Like you sometimes hear about people suppressing anger and these things would often lead to very kind of unstable mind states. This rather what this means is a natural process whereby you abandon it through wise attention, through attending in the right way, and through your meditation practice. That's what it actually means.
And by attending wisely and by meditating the right way, the lust or the desire will gradually come down until it's gone completely. And the reason why it is called suppressed here is because if you then get into a deep state of meditation based on that, then it will be a while before the desire comes back again. It will be, so to speak, suppressed for a while. You haven't actually suppressed it, but it will be, by definition, suppressed for a while before it can come back again. But don't take this to mean that you actually go out and actually forcefully suppress these things. That's not the point here at all. It's a natural phenomenon that happens through right practice. Yes. Yes, that's part of it. So this is, that's very much part of it. You have the standard kind of set that the Buddha talks about always is the seeing the gratification, understanding the gratification in something. In other words, the pleasure it gives, understanding the danger in that same thing. And the third thing is understanding the escape. And the point with sensual pleasure is that the danger is always much greater than the gratification. So when you fully understand both gratification and danger, and you put them against each other, you realize, gee, the danger is much worse, much than the gratification. So I better seek the escape, and that's the third thing. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to do with intellectual analysis, but it can do. For example, if you keep on reminding yourself that this will cause you to feel uncomfortable when you go on your weight the scales next time, maybe eventually that perception will arise naturally because you keep reminding yourself. So it can be like an intellectual method, or at least thinking about it, which takes you in that direction. And it's like, and that can happen with any kind of sensory experience. It's like remembering the danger in these things remembering that it's going to take you away from satisfaction and contentment. I mean, this is in a monastery. If you sit in your kuti and you kind of fantasize about sensual pleasures, there is no outlet for these things. All it leads to just your mind running around. And at the end of the day, you feel very discontent and very unhappy and very miserable if you do that. So if you remind yourself that, now that I have this fantasy, it's going to take me away from contentment. If you keep reminding yourself of that and you know that it's true, eventually that will undermine that fantasy happening in the first place. And this is how you reflect, and you have to keep reminding yourself, keep looking again and again and again. And as you do that, your meditation starts to improve. And then when your meditation starts to improve, it becomes even more obvious that this is going to be a hindrance for you, because now you see that there is another pleasure which depends on the fact that you don't fantasize in the first place. There's one aspect which lowers down the hindrances, and the other side, as the hindrances go down, the meditation improves. And these sort of support each other as you go along. And the whole thing becomes more and more clear as you do these things. That's very much part of the drying up process. So it is, how you reflect is very important. I mean, this is one of the things the Buddha says in the suttas as well. He talks about how does anger and desire arise in the mind. And anger and desire arise in the mind through wrong way of looking at things. And if you look at the beautiful aspect of something, desire will tend to arise. If you look at the repulsive aspect, anger will tend to arise. So if you then change your perception of these things, you look at them differently, you focus in a new way, instead of focusing on the negative aspect of a person, you focus on the beautiful aspect of that person, anger will not arise. So it's just how you look. But that looking differently takes training. You have to remind yourself again and again why there is a beautiful aspect in this person. You have to remind yourself again and again that the negative aspect is, you should have compassion instead of getting angry about the negative aspect, etc., etc. And as you keep, this is what mental development is all about. And as you keep changing your perception like that, the hindrances will start to get less and start to get reduced. That is really, this is mental development. This is a very important part of it. And all of these things come together here. Okay, I wasn't sure how far I would get in this sutta today. I'll go a little bit further, and then next time, in 2 weeks' time, I'll finish it off, because it's just going to be too much to do it all today here. So maybe this is quite a good place actually to stop, because that goes on with the ascetic practices after this. So one question, though, which comes up, and which also Bhikkhu Bodhi asks, I think, at the back of this book, and it was after this, the Buddha talks about his practice of ascetic practices, of self-mortification, which is strange when you consider the sequence here, because the Buddha has just been saying that, actually, it's no help to feel painful, racking, piercing feelings. That's not the issue. The issue is not whether you feel those painful feelings or not. The issue is whether you have abandoned sensual desire. That's what this whole previous passage is all about. And then he goes on to say, I did all this painful racking and piercing. I experienced all of these things through asceticism. And the question is, well, what is happening here? And there's a couple of possibilities as to what is happening here. And there are other versions of the sutta where this particular passage of the three similes actually comes after the ascetic practices. And then it makes sense, because then you can see that the Buddha is actually that understanding that the ascetic practices are useless comes after he has finished the ascetic practices. That helps. Another version of the sutta, there is part of these passages actually is missing. And the part which is missing is that part where he says that even if I feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, I will be incapable or capable. That part is missing. Once that part is missing, the kind of inconsistency falls out. It actually disappears from the sutta here. That is one way of explaining what's happening here. We have to remember that sometimes these suttas, because they are so ancient, sometimes there have been small flaws in the transmission, and the things may have changed slightly. That doesn't seem to have any effect at all on the overall message of the sutta. The message is the same. But sometimes you find these slight inconsistencies in the texts. And the last thing I want to point out, which is important here, is that what the Buddha is basically saying at this point, what he has understood at this point, is that his past life, when he lived the household life, and he's supposed to have lived in quite a wealthy household, where he had all the best in food, the best in clothes, the best that money could buy in those days, he has found out at this stage that all of that has to be abandoned if you are going to achieve enlightenment or awakening. That is what these similes are about. His primary understanding that is a dangerous pleasure, is a pleasure that does not lead to awakening. And then, of course, after his ascetic practices, then the other side of the story comes as well. He realized ascetic practices, the pursuing of pain and all these piercing and racking feelings, that too is not going to lead to awakening. So then you have the two sides of the story, the two important realizations, which later on become a very important part of the Buddha's teachings, which is part of the middle way, the understanding that neither the pleasure of the senses nor the pain of the senses, both of those are cul-de-sacs, if you like. They're going the wrong way. They're not going to get you anywhere in your practice. And that's where the middle way of the Eightfold Path comes into the picture.
Yes. Yes.
Ah.
Yeah. Hmm. That's a good question. Actually, I haven't even thought about that. That's a very good question. That there is a might be a connection there between his talking about these things. Yes, I suppose. I suppose maybe there is, and maybe the Buddha somehow knew that this man was ready to understand that. You know, if he explained it in a reasonable way, he might actually come around and understand that. You know, these practices aren't really all that useful. They don't get you anywhere. That could very well be the case. Yeah. Yes, exactly, exactly. That's a very good point. Yeah, thank you for that. So, yeah. Okay. Another thing, another small thing as well here, which is maybe worth us pointing out, is that the Buddha does here say that, well, actually, all these positive feelings, all the feelings that come through sensual pleasures, they are dangerous. But he also seems here not at this point. He doesn't seem yet to have made a clear distinction between the pleasures that come through the senses and the pleasures that come through meditation practice. Because later on he says, well, why do I fear these pleasures that come through the jhanas, through the deep states of meditation? So because later on he says that he feared them, it must mean that at a certain stage he didn't understand that distinction between the pleasures of the mind, of the jhanas, and the pleasures of the senses. And only later on does he make a clear analysis between the two things. So that is another very important point here. And this is one of the kind of red threads that runs through the suttas, is this distinction of the type of pleasure that does lead to enlightenment and the type of pleasure that leads away from enlightenment. And of course, the difference there is that the sensual pleasures, because they are caught up with desire, they're caught up with a lack of mindfulness, they're caught up with fantasies. And when you have desire, the mind is distorted because you see pleasure where maybe there is no pleasure. And that is a dangerous pleasure because precisely it leads to a lack of mindfulness. And therefore it also leads to lack of samadhi and concentration of the mind. Whereas the other pleasure is the exact opposite. It leads to mindfulness. It leads to presence of mind. It leads to an abandoning of distortion. And it makes your mind straight and clear and you have clarity instead. So they are once the Buddha analyzes these things correctly, it's very clear that these are very different types of happiness that we're dealing with here. Yes? I think you're right, and I think this, as you're saying, this story also underlines the same point. It doesn't look like the Buddha really was interested in jhanas at this point. He didn't really understand the significance, and it was going a different direction. That's true. That's good. And there's also another interesting thing which I was going to bring up, which comes a little bit later in the sutta, and that is the Buddha does this breath control meditation later on. And that breath control meditation, he calls it jhana. He calls it the breath jhana, the breathless jhana. And so there he uses the word jhana on a practice that really is an ascetic practice. It's like a self-mortification practice. He uses the word jhana. Now, after his awakening, jhana always means one thing. It means the four jhanas of the Buddha, very clearly defined. It never means anything else. And this, the point here is that prior to his awakening, he used the vocabulary that was around in India at that time in the same way as other people. So jhana just meant whatever other people called it. After his awakening, he gave it a very clear and precise meaning, which was the meaning that he used for the Dhamma, basically.
So there was a very clear distinction there between before and after his awakening here. So in the same way as jhana changed its meaning, in the same way words like arahant changed its meaning here, word like arya was given a new meaning here. And also, I think, and this is the point I'm trying to make, words like the last two immaterial attainments, the sphere of nothingness and the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, also, I would say, had two different meanings before and after his awakening here. So that when you read about this in the suttas, it actually does not mean what it meant afterwards. So that is exactly what you are saying. And I think that is, that is what argument I use. Good. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, I will stop there, and in a fortnight I will be back and finish this off. So, any last questions before we call it a day? No. Okay. Let's pay homage to the triple gem.